Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Blue Shield of Virginia against McCrady.
Chief Justice, may it please the court.
Mr. Bell.
This case presents two questions. First question is, was there an antitrust injury alleged so as to withstand a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6? And I use antitrust injury in the same vein as this court used it in Brunswick versus Pueblo Bowl-O-Mat. Second question was, Blue Shield exempt from the antitrust laws as being in the business of insurance under the McCarran-Ferguson Act? This is a class action with one plaintiff purporting to represent the class.
The class she claims to represent are the patients, are they not?
Patients, the patients. All patients who went to a clinical psychologist and who at the same time were entitled benefits on the Blue Shield contract. This plaintiff was an employee of Prince William County. Prince William County had a contract for medical services which they purchased from Blue Shield of Virginia. Plaintiff was treated by a clinical psychologist and sought reimbursement from Blue Shield of Virginia. That is the gist of the complaint. She wishes to be reimbursed. Her request for reimbursement was refused on the grounds that the plan only covered physician services and other allied health services which were supervised by and billed through a physician. Case is complicated by the fact that there was another case filed at the same time. They started out being heard together, and one was decided last year by the Fourth Circuit. It's called the VACP case. It's in that case, the district court ruled for the Blue Shield plans and psychiatrists, but the Fourth Circuit said that there was a restraint. The restraint was in the sector or area of restraining clinical psychologists by not covering them under these contracts. It was a plan that was devised, so the court held, by the two plans in Virginia, both of whom are in this case, along with the doctors and particularly the psychiatrists, to block out the clinical psychologist from being covered. Now, that is an antitrust allegation that's the base for this case brought by this patient of a psychologist. I'm going to spend a little time arguing the McCarran-Ferguson point because this court granted certiorari on a second case called Perino, and it's pending here now. It's very much in our case, and if we are exempt from antitrust coverage by McCarran-Ferguson, then you wouldn't necessarily reach the other point, which is antitrust injury. Unfortunately, though, the questions tie together because it has been held at one point in the case in the district court that there was a boycott. So if there was a boycott, then we have to get back to the same issue, target area. Was Mrs. McCready in the sector or the area where the antitrust violation took place? There are three elements that must appear to have an exemption under the McCarran-Ferguson Act. First, there must be the business of insurance. Second, there has to be state regulation of the activity in question. And third, it must appear that there's no no boycott. There can't be a boycott and still have coverage. They have the exemption. Now, there's no doubt there was state regulation here. That's what the lawsuit was about. The two plans would not follow the state law. They contested it and finally lost. And but they won part of the case, and that was that the Virginia Supreme Court said the statute required that they deal directly with psychologists. Virginia Supreme Court said that that was unconstitutional, was not corrected up until July 1, 1979, so we're talking about damages that accrued before July 1, 1979. But the same, I don't think it's contested that the state regulation, so if there, this was a business of insurance, this policy that they had that you could only get allied health or medical health services through a doctor, if that was underwriting or spreading of the risk within the meaning of the royal drug case, then we have the question, we have the business of insurance. So the only element left to be decided what would be was a boycott. Now, the boycott that the district court found, Judge Braun, this is the only mention that's been made of this in all of this litigation, was that that there was a boycott alleged. Well, at that time, he was dealing with a motion to dismiss involving the doctors, the plans, as well as Mrs. McCready's case. And I read that to mean that he was talking about a boycott in this primary level of this sector between doctors and psychologists. If so, then the same answer that would come from the argument I'm next going to make about antitrust injury would indicate that there was no boycott. So that's why I say the two issues tie together.
Mr. Bell, I'm not sure that I understand how we properly reached the McCarran-Ferguson Act issue. Now, the Court of Appeals didn't consider it, did it?
The Court of Appeals ignored it. Well, I won't say ignored it. They did not consider it.
And so normally, presumably, we wouldn't get into it. And does this case come to us on a motion under Rule 12b-6 of the federal rules?
It does.
And we have to assume that the allegations of the complaint are considered favorably to the pleader, and has the plaintiff below at least alleged both a boycott and coercion?
They alleged a boycott twice in the complaint.
So I wasn't sure how we would get into the McCarran-Ferguson Act issue.
Well, this was in the district court, and the Court of Appeals did not consider it, and it was called to the Court of Appeals' attention on petitions for rehearing. And I would assume that the court can deal with any issue that's in the case, part of the case. But I think that the short answer to the question is that in spite of the fact that a boycott is alleged, if the court should conclude that the injury suffered by Mrs. McCready was not in the area of the antitrust violation, and then there couldn't be a boycott. It wouldn't, even if there was a boycott, it would not relate to her. It wouldn't.
Well, if you're right on the standing issue, that would end it.
It would end it.
You never get to the McCarran-Ferguson.
You wouldn't have to get to the McCarran-Ferguson question. So I'll go on.
This is true also, isn't it?
I'll just mention one other thing about McCarran-Ferguson, and then I'll discontinue that argument. And that is that in the Royal Drug case, and there have been some other cases. There's one case in the Fourth Circuit where they said that peer review was a business of insurance. Perino in the Second Circuit says peer review was not. Well, this question we have is, seems to me, whether we are to cover clinical psychologists goes to the heart of the relationship between an insurer and a subscriber, a policyholder, as you will. It also goes to the heart of underwriting. Do you care to underwrite? Do you wish to underwrite this kind of business? And how will the risk be spread? Is the mechanics of it such that it bears directly on spreading the risk? I think it does, but I will go on to the next argument, because the next argument would end the case if we're right about it, and that is antitrust injury. Was there an antitrust injury here within the meaning of the decision in Brunswick versus Pueblo Bowl-O-Matic? The Fourth Circuit cited only two cases in support of that ruling. One was Ryder versus Sonneton, a case involving a direct purchaser and price fixing. Nothing like this case. They cited their own case of South Carolina Council of Milk Producers, where there had been a breakdown in the competitive level of the retail marketing. Milk was being sold at a loss leader. The farmers, the milk producers, brought a suit saying that it was adversely affecting the price of milk. And the Fourth Circuit went off on two points. One was whether these milk producers were in the sector of the economy which was endangered by the antitrust activity, the breakdown in competition, and then whether there was proximate cause which would lead from that to these milk producers. They decided this case almost on the same basis, which I think converts the antitrust law almost into a general tort statute. And it's difficult, though, to take any of the rules that I've found in the country, in all of the cases, in the circuits, and in the learned treatises, and apply them to facts. It's Judge Braun said it pretty well in a district court. He said that while standing an antitrust injury may not be the same issue, here there's no standing because there's no antitrust injury. He tested it rather than starting out with the definition. I think that Judge Mansfield in the Calderoni case almost hit on to a workable formula, but he kept changing from target area to target. And I suppose there can be some times where you wouldn't be a direct target, yet you'd still be covered if the breakdown, if you were in the area of the breakdown in the economy. So I first got off on the idea that maybe we ought to talk about targets, but I'm not certain that's the way to do it. And I end up, after looking at all of the cases, where there seems to be two clear groups. One is what some of the writers call categorization. That would be like a landlord, a shareholder, a creditor who doesn't have standing to complain about the antitrust violation. And then the others, it seemed to me, to get down to whether you're too far away from where the breakdown in the economy took place. This seems to me to be that kind of a case.
Well, Mr. Attorney General, it sounds like that particular approach, and maybe the target area too, is just an early way in the case to decide the question of causation and to avoid a long trial on that if it's clear enough. Even if you lose at this stage, you're going to be making the same argument down on the end of the case whatever injury that was suffered here wasn't caused by the breakdown in competition.
We would be making that argument.
You're still going to be making it later in the case.
But
you ought to be able to make it now and avoid a long trial.
We're saying that the question can be truncated because it appears as a matter of law that Mrs. McCready was far removed from the breakdown in the competition which was between the doctors.
Well,
that she was two steps away.
Isn't what you're saying in essence that antitrust injury is a narrower concept than injury which flows in a but-for causation way from an antitrust violation?
Exactly, and we think the Fourth Circuit treated it just like tort injury. Antitrust injury carries treble damages, and attorney's fees, and we don't think Congress, in fact, this court said so in Brunswick, that it was to be a narrow category. And the question, the problem is how to draw the line. It's very difficult to draw the line, but in this case, it seems to me that this lady is two steps away. She's a, what we might call a policy holder. She was in a market where you could buy all the insurance you wanted. There's no competitive breakdown there. She was also in another market. She was in the health services market. She could get a doctor or get a clinical psychologist, and that was unrestrained. The restraint was farther over, between the doctors and these plans for not covering clinical psychologists. So our argument is that if it was an antitrust violation, which the Fourth Circuit held in the other case, then you have to define the sector of the economy, draw a line around it, secondly. And then the next step, was she injured by something that happened within that cycle? And we say she was not. But I concede that it's not very easy to draw those lines. There's no bright lines in this area of the law that I can see. I guess that's why we had a case like Illinois Brick, because you're always worrying about whether someone's too far away.
Well, except for the provision in the contract, though, if the contract had covered the services of clinical psychologists, she would have been reimbursed.
She would have been if the coverage had run to clinical psychologists, as it does now.
Well, I suppose it's
been done now by statute.
If the contract included chiropractors, she went to a chiropractor, but
it's
a matter of contract then, isn't it?
That's it.
Is this a basis on which you, this direct and indirect point you were mentioning, is that the basis on which you distinguish Ryder against Sonatone, that in Ryder the injury occurred directly from the conspiracy to fix the prices?
Exactly. Precisely. In Ryder, Mrs. Ryder was a purchaser in a market where prices had been fixed. She was a direct, she suffered a direct injury. She was in the sector. Here, Mrs. McCready was a long ways from the sector. She would recover under a general tort theory on a but-for basis and on a foreseeability basis. You'd say that, yes, if they would not cover clinical psychologists, and they did it in violation of antitrust laws, there would be people in the chain that would be harmed, all the way down to at least to a policyholder. But that would be a general tort approach, which we say was not intended by the Congress.
Well, of course, I take it then that we should judge this case, although I'm sure you don't concede that there was an antitrust violation, but we must judge the case at this stage as though there was one. That the promise between, that the agreement was violated the antitrust laws.
You would have to because of the other case, which we lost and applied for certiorari, and certiorari was denied. So they found an antitrust violation by excluding these psychologists.
And the provision in the agreement between Blue Cross and the doctors.
Between?
Yes.
Well, in the agreement between the two plans, Blue Shield.
Exactly. Yes.
Blue Shield, and they said that was a restraint against the psychologists. And the restraint was a very peculiar thing. It was because they were not following the Virginia law. They were contesting the Virginia law.
What was the antitrust violation that was found in the other case?
Difficult to tell from reading the opinion, but I think it was, my best judgment was it was a restraint by the two plans, or between the two plans.
A restraint of what market, or of what?
The market for the services of a clinical psychologist.
People who in the market for mental treatment?
Just the doctors. Uh-huh. Just the clinical psychologists, not their patients. I think that's very clear from the Fourth Circuit.
But it's a restraint of competition, or a boycott, was it?
Well, you could call it a boycott, but the court wrote about two pages on the fact that they wouldn't find a boycott because they wouldn't find a boycott to be a per se violation in the medical field. It's a very confusing opinion. I would say that...
Well, until you know what the antitrust violation is, it's hard to understand an argument that there was that didn't cause this injury.
No, we know that the violation, the parameters of the violation, that it was in the area of the blocking out or boycotting the clinical psychologist, not giving them coverage. There's no way that I see from the opinion you could argue for a broader area. Now, if you could argue that the violation ran to a much broader area of the field of health services and people buying health insurance, then you'd have quite a different question. And that's what makes the case hard to draw the line. First, draw the line of where the violation was, and then connect the plaintiff to that area of the violation. The cases say the sector where the competition was endangered by a breakdown due to the antitrust violation, but it's an area, it's a fulcrum, it's some point of the violation.
Is the effect of the Fourth Circuit holding, majority holding, that they can't have this kind of a contract?
Well, they say you can't.
Excluding clinical psychologists.
But it's not quite that broad because the Virginia legislature, General Assembly of Virginia, passed a law that you had to deal directly with any of these allied health services. There's about four or five of them. One of them was clinical psychologist. It's the same as telling them they have to, if they're going to use their services, they have to deal directly with them. I don't believe the statute goes so far as saying you have to cover these people. They call it the direct user statute, and it was in litigation for several years, and it's been our clients have now lost it. But as I read the Virginia Supreme Court opinion, it is that you don't have to cover clinical psychologists. But if you do, you have to deal with them directly. You can't make them go through a physician. That's what it gets down to. I'd like to reserve a little time.
Mr. Carroll.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This is a case in which the plaintiff alleges in her complaint a direct financial injury from conduct which has already been proven to be a violation of the antitrust laws. The allegations in the complaint, in the other case that esteemed counsel referred to, the VACP case, are identical to the operative acts of antitrust violation charged in this complaint that's before the Court on this appeal from the reversal of a order dismissing a complaint under Rule 12b-6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, there are a couple of preliminary remarks I wanted to make before I pick up the questions of legal injury or antitrust injury and the possibility of McCarr and Ferguson exemption here. First, the petitioners' arguments in their brief are shot through with factual assertions that the respondent here can't be injured or she can't prove an antitrust violation as to her, and coupled with other assertions as to why their practices are defensible and why they are the business of insurance. It seems to me these factual assertions miss the mark in this Court. These assertions, for the most part, are contested, if not bitterly contested. To take one example, they argue that she cannot recover because her health insurance contract precludes payments to clinical psychologists. By contrast, we contend, based on the unanimous decision by the Court of Appeals in the VACP case and the evidence in that record, that for many years Blue Shield interpreted the very same contracts at issue here to treat clinical psychologists as physicians and to pay them directly. More specifically, from 1962 to 1972, they did interpret the contracts to pay clinical psychologists. So we think that regardless of who's right, and we think we're right, these are contested factual issues on important facts.
Well, are you suggesting that interpretation forever binds them?
No, sir, Your Honor, but I think it makes it very clear that when they make a decision in 1972 to restrict payments to clinical psychologists when they have been interpreting those same contracts to provide those payments, they are not expanding insurance coverage. They are cutting off benefits to a group of competitors that they view as a competitive threat.
Well,
and that...
I don't get where the competitive threat between what two entities?
Between the physicians who control...
I'm talking about the contract. The contract was not made by the physicians, was it?
The contract?
Yeah.
The terms of the contract are developed by Blue Shield of Virginia.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well,
and the contract...
And you're complaining that this contract is now construed to exclude the psychologists.
No, sir, that's not our complaint. Our complaint charges that they failed to make payments for services of clinical psychologists. We don't even plead the contract. The contract's not even before this court, except by virtue of the fact that petitioners have inserted
then,
it.
Then you've confused me. You just said that at one time they construed the contract to include direct payments to clinical psychologists. And now they construe it another way.
Yes, sir. They never changed the contract. They just stopped the practice. At one time they paid.
Well, then my question to you was, does the construction of the contract in one way forever bind them to continue to construing it the same way?
No, sir, I don't think that would be
correct. Well,
then
you've changed your answer.
No, I misunderstood Your Honor's question.
Mr. Brown, what exactly is the difference that you don't get paid pursuant to contract or without contract? The complaint is that you don't get paid.
That's right, Your Honor, absolutely correct. And that's...
Well, I'm kind of lost on your answer there. Suppose the Blue Shield put in its contract that we won't pay clinical x-ray people. Would that be a cause of action?
If they put in their contract that we will pay?
Will
not pay? If that decision was an act that reflected an antitrust violation, there might be a cause of action,
in my opinion. I would assume that if Blue Shield says, in order to violate the antitrust law, we'll do this, I certainly didn't assume that.
Yes, Your
Honor.
They
didn't say a word about antitrust.
They might not say that, but suppose the decision to put a clause in the contract occurred in this way. Suppose the surgeons decided that they didn't want family physicians to treat warts without consulting a surgeon. And suppose further that the minutes of the
meeting... I'm talking about insurance contracts. I'm not talking about surgeons.
Well, I'm talking about the people who make up the language in these contracts physicians who control Blue Shield.
Did the physicians make up this contract?
They made the decision to exclude...
Did they make up the contract? Because I'm going to ask you where that is in the record.
Where the physicians make up the contract?
Yeah.
Well, Blue Shield makes up the contract.
I thought so.
And Blue Shield is the participating physicians, as even the petitioners say in their brief. It is a collective of physicians.
But the physicians didn't draw the contract. Blue Shield drew the contract.
As the agent of the physicians, Your Honor.
Well, wholly apart from all this, you're alleging a conspiracy, aren't you?
We're alleging a combination, joint action, to restrain trade and to boycott clinical psychologists from direct payments. Yes, Your Honor.
And it's between the physicians and Blue Shield. That's a conspiracy.
Why
are you afraid to say so?
The conspiracy is the member physicians, the directors of Blue Shield, and the two Blue Shield plans that collaborated together later to also reinforce. Yes, Your Honor.
When you won on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
You've won in another case on that, haven't you?
That's correct, Your Honor. So the only issue...
Mr. Furr, would your position be the same, and would Mrs. McCready have standing if she had purchased the policy directly?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor.
Your position would be exactly the same through the employer.
She would still have standing.
And she presumably could have bought a policy that would have covered clinical psychologist services that did not require going through a physician. from some other source. Is that not correct?
Theoretically, that's possible, Your Honor. The only difficulty with that is most of these health care policies are part of your fringe benefit as an employee, and very few people have the resources to go out and make an independent purchasing decision. They take the policy.
Let's go back to if she were buying it directly. Presumably, other sources would be available. How would she have standing, then, for this kind of an antitrust action?
If she bought a policy and part of the policy reflected an antitrust violation, and
These same circumstances.
She would have standing if, in fact, she could show there was a violation, or at this stage of the litigation, plead there was a violation, plead causation, and in fact, that she had been injured by the violation, by reason of the antitrust laws. She would have standing. And I think that's really the only issue that's before this court today because of the question how the McCarran-Ferguson issue is presented. And I'd like to turn to the issue of standing to sue under Section 4 of the Clayton Act. Just by way of summary, we think that her complaint on its face alleges sufficient facts to demonstrate the likelihood that she has been injured by an antitrust violation. And to cut off her lawsuit at this early stage would defeat two key purposes of the federal antitrust laws: compensation to victims and deterrence of practices which hinder competition, without her ever having a full day in court. Second,
well, you don't suggest that the test is different at this stage, the legal test is different at this stage of the lawsuit than it would be after the trial is over, do you? It's just maybe the facts aren't as fully developed as they would be at trial.
Your Honor, I think that although the Supreme Court has never really addressed the issue of standing to sue within the special context of Section 4 of the Clayton Act, that the test, or at least the stringency of the application of the test, might well differ. As esteemed counsel mentioned earlier in his argument, he relies on the Brunswick case to define the concept of antitrust injury. Well, that came up after a full trial on the merits, not at the preliminary stage of moving to dismiss a case where the ability to show the relationship of the injury to the anti-competitive practice has not even been fleshed out by discovery, by not even a summary judgment hearing. So, yes, I do suggest that, Your Honor.
Do you suggest that at this stage it'd be just a flat but-for causation?
I think if the plaintiff alleges, that's a threshold requirement. An allegation of an antitrust violation, an allegation of cause in fact, and there has to be somehow on the face of the complaint, I would suggest, at least a possible relationship that in terms of the injury to competition and the injury that was inflicted on her.
What if I plead in a complaint that I'm a landlord and I had a tenant who has been subjected to an antitrust violation, and as a result, he's gone out of business, and as a result, I have not been able to collect my rent? Do you think that that is antitrust injury?
I think that the statute is on its face would allow that case to go forward, at least into a factual investigatory stage.
Well, what if the factual investigatory stage fully supported the allegations of the complaint and nothing more? That there was a landlord, there was a tenant, the tenant had been subjected to an antitrust violation, gone out of business, and the landlord couldn't collect his rent.
Well, I think that most of the courts that have dealt with that have and you're speaking to one category of antitrust standing, the so-called landlord cases under the direct injury test. I think the courts have usually cut off injury there or the right to assert injury because of the possibility of duplicative recovery. I suggest that we don't have those facts here, but I would have to say the statute on its face is broad enough to allow that, to allow the case to go forward.
Mr. Fair, isn't this really a fight between the psychiatrist and the psychologist? And if so, how did you happen to exclude the psychologist from the plaintiffs in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it is just a fight between the psychologist.
I didn't say just a fight, but isn't it a fight or primarily a fight?
I believe that it is a situation where, because of the peculiar nature of the health care reimbursement plan here, the injury inflicted on Ms. McCready was an integral part of an effort by the Blue Shield physicians to cut off competition from competing non-MD health care providers.
And if I understand that, but it still seems curious to me that the parties primarily concerned are absent from this litigation.
Well, they've already prevailed in a case in which the court has denied certiorari, Your Honor. That's the VACP case.
What did that case hold? I don't recall it specifically. I remember we did deny certiorari.
That case held that the joint action by the defendants, the Blue Shield defendants, in this identical time frame to withdraw payment and to exclude clinical psychologists from direct payment for their services was a violation of the antitrust laws.
But wouldn't you have had a stronger case if you had included them so you wouldn't be arguing about standing?
Well, Your Honor, the two cases proceeded together, and in fact, in the district court's decision, which I believe is in the appendix, the standing challenge was made to the psychologist. Judge Bryan allowed them to go forward, and at the same time, in fact, in the same order, dismiss Ms. McCready's complaint for lack of standing. So they were proceeding simultaneously until the district court ruled.
But psychologists have never been a party to this case.
Not to this case, because this is a treble damage case asserted by a subscriber who has been denied her reimbursement benefits.
But you conceded, I thought, in response to Justice Rehnquist's question, that this is like the landlord and tenant case.
No, Your Honor, I would not concede that.
I thought you said that that there would be a recovery in response to his question.
I don't think that the Section 4 of the Clayton Act, by its terms, would exclude that case. I don't think Ms. McCready's case is the same. I think, just as the Fourth Circuit found below, the injury inflicted on her is direct. In the landlord case, you have an indirect injury, and courts have dismissed those because they're indirect or remote or fortuitous. All the kinds of language the courts have traditionally used when they wanted to cut back on the ambit of liability to which a defendant is exposed, even though, A, a violation has been proved, and, B, cause in fact has been established. And if I could, I would like to turn to the language of Section 4 of the Clayton Act and why I think that it cannot be construed so narrowly in the circumstances that some of the lower courts have done. I wanted to make certain at the outset that we recognize that the standing concept here is a special one. We're not talking about standing in the sense of Article 3 and whether there's a case or controversy that's justiciable where someone has a stakehold in the outcome. This is clearly a special kind of antitrust standing which would, if adopted, and certainly if the petitioner's rule would be accepted, would limit actions in the federal courts for federal causes of action which reflect important federal policy. Because the limitation would involve an imposition of a judicial restriction on the exercise of congressional power, the apparent exercise of congressional power, we believe it is very important to look to the language of the statute itself and the purposes of the statute in order to make certain that a restrictive reading is justified. The statute itself says that any person who shall be injured in his business or property by reason of anything forbidden in the antitrust laws may sue in the district courts and recover threefold his damages plus reasonable cost of suit and attorney's fees. The language is clear and unambiguous.
Well, then I come back. I'm confused about your responses, and I want to clear it up. I come back to your response to Justice Rehnquist. Under the language you just read, is it your position that the landlord was injured by the antitrust action because the tenant could no longer pay his rent?
If the landlord has a financial injury and he can prove the nexus between that financial injury and an antitrust violation.
Well, you heard his hypothetical. The antitrust violation put the tenant out of business. The tenant may have some recovery for that violation, of course, but does the landlord have a recovery? That's the question.
The statute on its face, Your Honor, is broad enough to allow that recovery. And the question this Court, I'm sure, wants is whether the lower court decisions restricting that should be the rule of this Court. And that is the issue.
In fact, if we rely on the literal language, it would allow a shareholder of the landlord to recover, too.
That's correct, Your Honor, and this has bothered the lower courts in a series of what I would call pigeonhole cases. They have developed categories that would restrict particular plaintiffs, the shareholder exception.
But you're not arguing we should read the statute literally, are you?
I think the statute has to be read in terms of, first, its language, and, second, the legislative history.
Well, are you arguing that we give it its full literal meaning and allow everyone to recover who is injured by reason of an antitrust violation?
Well, we would argue that you allow everyone to recover who is injured. Well, first, we argue you would allow everyone at least to proceed with his case past the 12B6 stage, who alleges that he has been injured by
reason of an antitrust violation. You'd allow the shareholder of the landlord whose tenant was injured to proceed beyond a motion to dismiss that?
Unless allowing him to proceed would defeat antitrust policy rather than promote it. And this is where I think the Brunswick case would come into play as a possible rational reading of the statute to impose by the judiciary a limit on the ambit of liability. But the statute was designed to deter violations. And the statute was designed to see that people who have been injured because of those violations recover.
Well, are you asking us to overrule Illinois Brick, for example?
No, Your Honor, I'm not, because I think the Illinois Brick case reflects a decision to cut off the risk of duplicative recovery and the administrative impossibility of trying to trace damages through successive chains.
You don't have to win on the landlord's case to win your case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We have a direct injury.
You might as well argue that.
We believe you are
saying it's a direct injury.
We believe that our client would prevail under any of the three tests that the lower courts have developed in their struggle to limit the breadth of Section 4 of the Clayton Act. She's within the target area, as the Fourth Circuit correctly held. She has an immediate direct injury. It's not derivative. It's not fortuitous. And finally, she's a reasonably foreseeable plaintiff, which is a sort of hybrid test that some other courts have adopted.
Well, Mr. Furr, you say she's in the target area, but how do you define the target area?
Well,
I thought the target of the conspiracy in your answer to Justice Powell was the competition from psychologists who compete with psychiatrists. And the psychiatrists don't like that competition and want to curtail it. So couldn't one it's a question of where you put the label, I suppose. Couldn't one define the target area as the competitors that the defendants want to drive out of business or harm?
You could define it that narrowly, Your Honor, but if you did, I think a whole class of people who've suffered a very real financial injury would not be allowed to recover, and defendants might very well be able to profit because they would not have been forced to give up the entire pie of their antitrust violation. And since Congress has said they're supposed to give it up plus treble, I don't think we should — I certainly don't want to endorse a restriction that would allow defendants to keep part of the illicit gains from the antitrust violation.
Well, except that I suppose that if the psychologist got less business because of this, he can recover, can't he?
He could recover, but as the Fourth Circuit found —
And that's all the defendants have taken away from their competitors is what he could recover in that case, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but that's —
Well, isn't that the entire pie?
No, sir, because the people who lose patients have a claim. In this case, McCready stayed with her psychologist because it was the therapist of her choice. He got paid completely. She's out of pocket, the money for the antitrust violation. And the reason she's out of pocket, you have to understand how the health care practice works. Under the major medical policy, the patient pays the provider and then files a reimbursement claim. And depending on the different circumstances, it could be an 80-20% split. In order to limit the threat of these allied health care providers, which is documented in the VACP case, the Blue Shield board and physicians had to impose a restriction on reimbursement. Otherwise, if they didn't impose the restriction, she would have gone to her provider, she would have paid him, there would have been no impetus to cut down on people going to independently practicing clinical psychologists.
Well, in terms of the conspiracy that you're talking about, would it be any different if the doctors who didn't want competition from psychologists went to all the banks in town and said, don't lend them any money, or went to the suppliers of pharmaceutical goods of one kind and said, boycott all the psychologists because we want to drive them out of business? Would she then have a claim because her psychologist was driven out of business?
Well, that would be a harder case, but fortunately...
Would that be a harder case?
It would be a harder case because if they went to, if I understood your question, to the banks and simply combined to put economic pressure to deny loans to psychologists,
but here,
where would there be an injury to her?
Well, that's really my question, because here, as I understand the conspiracy, it's putting the economic pressure on the psychologist of saying you're not going to get insurance reimbursement for when you get... How is that different from saying you're not going to be able to borrow
because
money?
Because the very instrumentality used to achieve that were all the subscribers who were entitled to the benefit. They used them as vehicles to deliver the antitrust punch. And that's about as direct an injury as you could possibly imagine.
It hurt every client who didn't abandon her psychologist or his psychologist.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was the purpose of the plan, and that's what the Fourth Circuit found below.
And the only way the psychologists got hurt was by the ones who did abandon them.
That's correct. And then they lost business in the process.
But, Mr. Furr, under the terms of the policy, which were known at the time of purchase, this reimbursement wouldn't be made. And couldn't the employer or Mrs. McCready have obtained other insurance coverage that would have allowed payment? I mean, they knew that. When it was obtained.
Well, if Your Honor, please, we address that in our brief, but there's no reason to suspect that, in fact, this was known. The practice was to pay. As a matter of fact, she had every reason to expect that she would be paid, and her employer, as a political subdivision of the Commonwealth of Virginia, had every reason to expect that Blue Shield would have obeyed the state statute that also required payment at that time. So there's nothing in this record. Of course, the case only comes up on a complaint.
But if that's a defense, it still is in the case.
Well, it might be a defense in the case, like McCarran Ferguson might be months down the road when the facts are developed. But it certainly isn't a defense at this stage of the proceeding. To try to sum up on this part of the argument, she meets all of the classic tests that the lower courts have imposed of antitrust standing. To cut off her complaint at this early stage of the proceeding would serve no important federal purpose. There are no reasons to cut the complaint off now. There would be no double recovery, as in the landlord case possibility, no complex problems of proof or apportionment of damages. And proceeding with her case would not in any way interfere with competition in the healthcare market. Allowing her case to go forward would ensure at least the possibility of compensation to her and would discourage defendants from adopting restrictive practices which could ultimately, if successful, exclude psychologists by making it too expensive for subscribers to consult them. So that we believe that if the court has to harmonize any kind of restriction rule at all on the language of Section 4 of the Clayton Act, as per Brunswick, it simply should be that we shouldn't allow an antitrust plaintiff to go forward, as possibly in Brunswick, where actually the recovery of damages would tend to defeat competition rather than promote it. Here, by making her whole and making the defendants stop their practice of refusing to pay her, we also encourage competition. And in that light, she certainly should be allowed to go forward. Now, I want to just very quickly speak to the McCarran-Ferguson Act exemption. We allege a boycott that's sufficient under Berry to proceed. More importantly, even if the business of insurance was an issue here, it certainly cannot come up on a motion to dismiss. There's nothing in McCready's complaint that talks about underwriting of risk, distribution of risk, or insurance contracts. And if under Royal Drug, if the defendants want to demonstrate that their decision, which we say was simply an antitrust conspiracy, was in fact an insurance decision, they have the affirmative obligation of proving that in a plenary proceeding. There is nothing in the complaint that allows them to even make that argument. And therefore, the McCarran-Ferguson Act exemption is not properly before this court. For all of these reasons, we think the case
We did grant certiorari on the question, didn't we?
Well, Your Honor, the certiorari grant was not, as I understand it, confined to any issue. Both of the issues had been raised, as I recall.
Yes.
So the certiorari grant was not defined in that respect.
Well, but both questions were stated in the petition.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And we just granted the petition.
That's right, Your Honor. And we think, insofar as the grant did deal with the McCarran-Ferguson Act, it's improvident.
Improvident grant of certiorari.
That's right, Your Honor.
On the second question.
That's right. That's correct, Your Honor. That would be the position we would take. Thank you very much.
Well, do you have anything further, Mr. Powell?
About two minutes, if it pleases the Court. On the motion to dismiss, the idea of a motion to dismiss, counsel opposite says we ought to have a full-scale hearing. As I understand the administration of the judicial process, courts decide cases like Brunswick to teach the lower courts and the lawyers how to handle complicated matters. Now, if our case does fit into Brunswick, then we would be entitled to a judgment of dismissal. That gets down to just one issue. There's only one thing dividing us, as I understand the argument. We both agree. The argument is that Mrs. McCready's argument, that you have to have an antitrust violation and causation. That's all you have to allege. I say that Brunswick teaches one other step, one other factor. You have an antitrust violation, and then you have to have a sector a market in which competition is injured. Now, that's said in Brunswick. It says there that antitrust laws are designed to protect competition and not competitors. Now, the competition is without doubt in this case that the competition injured is between the psychiatrist and the clinical psychologist. So you have to have causation that relates to that. To that area,
Bill,
so we have to find that area.
May I ask a question upon that? I've been thinking about this after the question I asked your opponent. Supposing it's kind of hard to think through the case with the insurance in it. Supposing the doctors had gotten together and said, we're going to boycott the banks in order to get the banks to refuse to do business with the psychologists in order to drive them out of business. And they were successful. And some banks lost business as a result of the boycott. Now, they're aiming at the psychologists, but they hurt the banks in accomplishing their objective.
Well,
could they be covered or not?
Well, they might be because the way you describe it, they're both the subject matter of the boycott, the bank and the psychologist.
See, but his theory, as I understand it, and the colloquy with Justice White, is that, well, they're refusing to pay benefits to people who do business with the psychologists that we want to put out of business.
That's their claim to the insurance company that's denied. They pay the provider, and they put in their claim to the Blue Cross, and they get turned down.
Got turned down on the grounds that they were not physician services. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty.
That's in their complaint. They say that the plan is a plan on which payment for psychological services are made when those services are rendered by a physician. Mm-hmm. That was the plan. In which he was a subscriber through the county. Mm-hmm. But the example Justice Stevens just gave, it's sort of typical of this area of the law. It is on the landlord question. I finally decided that all those cases fit into something you would call derivative. They're derivative rights. They're shareholders, landlords, creditors. In this case, almost is a derivative case. I've not argued that, but she's a policyholder under this plan, and she's almost in the shape of a derivative right. But you can't decide this case under any sort of a magic of what's been held in a lot of other cases. Each case has to go on its own. You have to have some general principles, and I think those three factors that I just gave are the factors, and not the two that my opposition argues for. One is a general tort, and the other one is an antitrust type tort. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Hopper.